LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host, Greg Moffat. This podcast is an audio version of a video recorded by Thomas Sheridan and myself for Thomas's show, Not Quite the Witching Hour.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Not Quite the Witching Hour with myself, Thomas Sheridan, as your host. I know it's been a while since we did one, but we're having a special one tonight. I've already done two videos on the subject of liminal space as a kind of an introductory one on this channel, and another chat I did with Presley Benson on her channel. And now we're here to add a new flavor to the mix, and what better person than my old friend and colleague, Greg Moffat from LegalizeFreedom.com, and that's Legalize Freedom about an S and a Z, or Z, as the Americans call it, who's going to come here. I'm going to talk about the subject of liminal spaces because it's kind of like developing into something new and different, and it's really catching my attention lately. And even though we kind of always knew about, or any of us grew up on kind of like Stanley Kubrick films, but let's see if we can add a new flavor into this discussion. So welcome, Greg, and thanks for coming along for this.
Oh, you're very welcome, Thomas. Always a pleasure to speak with you and to be on the show with you today. I mean, we've done many talks together over the years, many subjects, and this is one that we have touched upon either directly or indirectly.
Yeah.
Many times, haven't we, in our talks about ontology and whatnot.
Yeah, and it crosses over to many other things, such as like ambient music and cinema and art, paintings and art. There's so much in this. So, and also, I haven't got the same interest in the topic then that I do now. So, for those of you who don't know, liminal spaces are strange, almost abandoned locations. They can be an empty shopping mall late at night or an empty factory with not much machinery and an open space, a flickering light in the background. They can be my favorite one, a hotel ballroom that's completely empty except for one table with a white tablecloth on it. We've all experienced the sense of strangeness and the in-betweenness of these, sort of like they're almost like portals in consciousness, and it causes they are slightly spooky, they're full of trepidation, and they force us to actively think about moving between different states, and they have a great importance, I think, in the development of personal consciousness. So, Greg, tell us a little bit about how you got interested in this topic.
Well, it was probably through the twin lens of, oddly enough, these things seem disconnected at first, but music and architecture.
Yeah.
So, I've always been interested in architecture. In fact, I might even have mentioned this in one of our previous conversations, but when I was a young boy, one of the main occupations besides train sets was playing with Lego and, you know, wanting to construct buildings. And I spent a lot of time drawing buildings as well. So it's one thing that in my young life, I imagined that I might do, you know, in my adult life, was be an architect. So the built environment has always been, you know, part of my, you know, kind of thought process, my awareness. You know, anywhere I go, I'm very aware of the buildings and how people respond to them or don't do. And I'm, you know, surprised, actually, by how much people are not aware of the built environment around them, including the buildings that they live in. My regular Legalized Freedom guest, James Hard Consular, is very good on this. You know, he writes a lot about, he has an eyesore of the month, for example, on his website of you know, an abomination in architecture. So always just aware of that, and liminal spaces that we're talking about, many of them will be in buildings or round buildings, as it were. So that's how that ties in. The music thing was I guess in the very early days, musicians or bands that spoke about actually about the built environment or about dystopian themes that played into that. So Hawkwind, for example, this will resonate with you. Gary Newman,
yeah,
you know, John Fox, Underpass. Is there a more built environment, dystopian liminal space song than John Fox's Underpass. Look it up, guys, on YouTube. You'll find it's a great song. So that played a lot into my consciousness as well. I was really into these musicians with these dystopian themes, and again, they were speaking about architecture playing in there. And of course, Ray Bradbury, which we've spoken about before, the English author, and how central the built environment was to his writing, in like High Rise. Again, Hawkwind's song High Rise is basically, based on Bradbury's novel, the same name, The Concrete Island by Bradbury. So all of these things coming together, this is what drew me into this idea about liminal spaces. And of course, when I was very young, actually going back to some of my earliest memories, I had this weird fascination with substations, electricity substations, and the spaces around them. They'd be fenced off for obvious reasons because it was dangerous to be near them. So spaces like that, on the edge of town, Edgelands. I remember in a recent online conversation that you and I had, I recommended the book Edgelands about that. Speaking about these kind of like so much of the land, even in Great Britain, that is, who does it belong to? Nobody lives there, nobody goes there. For example, the spaces next to railway tracks, between the track and the back garden of somebody's house, who owns that? Who goes there? Nobody, So all of this played into an ongoing interest that I've had, lifelong, in liminal spaces.
Of course, you could add to that, as we spoke the other day, about that Brian Eno's music for airports, which is kind of a sonic version of that. And you just remind, when you said power substations, I have the same feeling with actual turbine rooms and power stations. They also have that kind of energy, that's liminal space to them as well. Does not ne usually never put anybody in them, but they have these huge machines generating electricity. And I'm reminded of, I think, one of the UFO albums. I think it's the Lights Out. There's actually, I think it's Pete Way is in a power station wearing a green overalls or something, if I have a faint memory of that. But I remember like that being a very powerful image on the cover of that album, the inside of a power station. But yeah, I mean, I think I was thinking about this morning, and I think a huge factor in it is there's almost a processional quality to it. In the same way you might have a procession for religion, like the church going down the middle of the pews, the priest focused towards the altar. I think there's a strong element of that in it. You have the same. You say, suppose you're in, say, an empty shopping center late at night. You're looking down. If you look at so many of the photographs online, which they are used to sort of highlight what a liminal space is, there's a very strong emphasis on the vanishing points at the corners. The vanishing points are almost like pulling you in into infinity, and there's a very strong processional quality, or the anticipation of a processional quality within that liminal space. What's at the end of the corridor? What's at the end of the ballroom, the empty ballroom? What's at the end of the empty turbine room?
Yeah, you mentioned your feed broke up a little bit on my side. I don't know if it did on your side when you were talking about the UFO album Lights Out, which was shot in one of the power rooms at Battersea Power Station.
I
And
always wondered that. I always, you've answered a question I've always wondered, yeah.
that's where it was. And that's also obviously Pink Floyd Animals.
Animals, yeah.
Obviously that featured Battersea Power Station exterior shot. And what's the other one? Hawkwind. I think it was PXR5.
It's the plug that's wired wrong.
Well, actually, oh, maybe it's not that album then.
No,
But
it's not that one, yeah.
one of the Hawkwind albums has got a shot again from the interior of Battersea Power Station, because there was a Facebook post that I read recently by someone who I follow who does posts about album covers. And he was talking about, album covers that had featured Battersea Power Station. So you're very, very right. Like, what a liminal space, because the power stations run. Yes, they need humans there to maintain them. But basically, when the guy, goes out for a fag break or whatever, these things just keep going anyway. And that makes me think about, what would happen if suddenly all humans were gone from the planet. Which things would keep running without us, and which things would break down first. And you mentioned the shopping mall, the not the abandoned one. There's lots of examples of those, but just the shopping mall at night, as it were, as a liminal space. And they're powerful images, and I don't really know why they resonate so strongly with us. Like, why are we even having this conversation, for example? There's something going on there, isn't there?
Yeah, it's almost like we're detecting a signal on a radio coming through, and we know that behind all the static is a sound. This is what's so beautiful, I think, about this liminal space thing. We're almost at the forefront of a new form of psychology or something like that. Another place in London has that as well. Have you ever been to the Tate Modern Gallery?
I have, but you're talking like 20 years ago, and I don't know, something about it I didn't like. There was too much art there.
Oh, it's
There was too
awful.
much stuff.
It's mostly,
I found it,
but
I found.
downstairs, a gigantic turbine room is completely empty, and they usually project videos on the wall and things like that. And that's an enormous space, and you do get that vibe. It's also interesting too that it's connected across the St. Paul's by a bridge over the river. It's almost like the Church of Art. They're like two kinds of churches. But that's a lot.
So no, I didn't enjoy my experience there. I went there only because a bunch of other people. Actually, if I remember rightly, it was some friends from Australia, who were visiting, and they wanted to go because it was one of their top 10 things to do in London.
Yeah, I only liked it because of the architecture. And I like those kinds of structures like that. Like, that's a 1920s power station that was now an art gallery, and it still has the huge kind of brick chimney. There's a few places like that in the UK. Have you ever seen the entrance to the Mersey Tunnel at Birkenhead? They have a ventilator, and it's an upside down version of the rune, which is also the insignia of CND, the death rune. And that's like one of those kinds of buildings, the structures that, even though it's not particularly a liminal space in there, it has that same kind of energetic quality in the, like I said, in the architecture itself. It's all part, like you said, we know there's something there. And we know that there is a great sort of like reward in there, but we're only in the early days. It's like, of exploring it.
Yeah, and that's interesting in itself because I think in one way here we are, as I commented with my in my conversation with Neil MacDonald, just a few days ago. I mean, the first quarter of the 21st century is already ending, and that's mind blowing to people like you and me who grew up in the 70s and the 80s. But this increasing interest, this hyper consciousness. Why now? Because you would think everything's online, everything's mundane, everything's explainable. Who cares? Who gives a shit? And yet there's certain things that we seem to be zeroing in on, as items of particular interest and resonance, from the past. And again, that plays into hauntology, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think there's a huge element of like a reaction to the digital world. It's almost like
Yes.
what, and you do have to wonder at times, was the digital world created for that reason? Was it created so we'd expand our consciousness, but not through it, but away from it? And the more I think about it, it seems like a lot of these subjects that ontology, and a lot of the weird 14 stuff, even the ancient megaliths, even the symbolism in cinema, big one, as well as the liminal spaces, they were generated essentially on the internet, but they're not concerned with the internet. They're concerned with our conscious development.
Yeah, exactly. And I mentioned, sort of retro music and, various trends in culture that have been, making themselves, becoming prevalent in the early 21st century, that speak to the past, but they're kind of dependent on, the internet for their popularization, reaching the mass consciousness, even the people who are not aware of these things, back in the day. Vaporwave, is a great example of that as a subgenre, as a kind of a trend in music. And that's something that entirely speaks to the past, resonates with the past, revives that, but couldn't exist without the internet.
Exactly. Now people are watching this and saying, "What the hell are these two on about?" I wouldn't blame you, but a friend of mine, an author friend of mine here in Ireland, James Bruce, he never heard of liminal spaces, and but read my article on it, and left the comment that he said, "What a, the ultimate scene for him of that was the final scene in 2001: A Space Odyssey." Where the astronaut sees himself in the bed as an elderly man in this blank white room. So, those of you who remember that scene and remember how it affected you, as well as lots of other Stanley Kubrick films, scenes in his films, that's what we're talking about. The strangeness of that scene, the way it caused you to be bewildered and puzzled, but also the stark mortality of the eyes, the man beholding his own death. I think we couldn't really have this conversation if it wasn't for Kubrick's movies.
No, and I'd point people actually, viewers, to your recent Substack article, where you've a series of visual images from Kubrick's movies, highlighting some of the spaces that he includes there. And I'd even forgotten how many of them that there were. It was over and over and over again. So whatever you say about Kubrick, his motivations, or his inspirations and what he's trying to do with his movies, he's definitely, drawing something there together, isn't he? And there's a I've thought so many times about Kubrick movies when I've been in places like hotels
Yeah.
and and whatnot. It's just sort of thinking, this is like, where am I? When am I? What am I? Because again, hotels are, having recently spent 10 days in one or in a several, the people that you meet there, the reasons that you are there, reflecting somewhat the comment that I made to you about, when I shared the link to Brian Eno, his Music for Airports album. It's kind of everyone's there, but that's not where they belong, or they might want to be there in the case of a hotel, but they're always moving on. So it's almost like, things are allowable in liminal spaces that wouldn't be otherwise, but equally people feel unsettled by them, if you see what I mean. So I certainly feel that when I'm at an airport. I see people behaving in ways in liminal spaces they would not do otherwise, if you see what I mean, in their regular day-to-day lives. Usually with some kind of license that is kind of like, well, you shouldn't really do this. Well, I can do it now because I'm in this space that nobody owns, or that I don't belong in there, you don't belong in there, that's only temporary, as it were.
Yeah, you've reminded me with another album cover there. Speaking of airports, "All That You Can't Leave Behind" by U2 has a very a classic photo on the cover of the baggage carousel. That's another one. I find if you go, you ever like every time I seem to land in airports anywhere I go, it's either always seems to be early in the morning at late at night, and all the baggage carousels are all shut down, and that's a classic liminal space, and you might find that you have. It says on the board, your bags are coming through Carousel 7. And you walk down this room to Carousel 7, and there's only you and a few other people. And then you're sitting there maybe at like 1 in the morning, there's no one around, and you're looking at this thing waiting. And then all of a sudden, the motor kicks on, and the carousel, the baggage conveyor belt starts moving. There's something very powerful and intense about that. It's almost like you get a miniature fright of sorts. The way this thing, especially only if you're at a quiet or a late night airport or early morning, when that carriage carousel just kicks off, it's almost like you feel like the airport is a creature coming to life.
Yeah, the baggage carousel is kind of like a life journey in a way, isn't it? That's why it just suddenly popped into my mind, sort of. And reincarnation is when you you miss your bag first time round, and you have to wait for it again, as I did when I flew to New Zealand. It was literally like, oh yeah, so I brought her suitcase, which is pink. I'm not looking for a black one as I normally would. Oh shit, that's gone by. So round it comes again, you know, round and round and round.
And it had a serpent-like quality in the way it zigzags. And even those rubber mats that they have on it, it's almost like a reptilian scaly vibe to them. You ever notice that? The way they kind of fold over one another. There's a kind of a, there's something, or it's almost, it's a machine that's almost organic. And it comes to life in your kind of, your engagement with it. You know, and you said like it's life story right there. I often find myself looking at a bag coming out on its own that might belong to someone. It, there's something about the there's something about that, the bag coming out on its own. Who owns it? Where is it going? Where did it come from? And I think the airports are a classic example of that concept of the in-between state. So that's what how generally liminal spaces are described as being in between places. And that's not only an in-between between you know departure and destination, but it does kind of you know, you're often going through an airport to be a different person than what you were at home. You know, you're almost you have you may be going to work, you may be going to see something. You're different. You're becoming different.
I think there's you're hinting at something very powerful there, actually. And this is something that I feel. You can tell me how you think about this, Thomas, and viewers can maybe comment on this. But this is well documented that, as I say, I've just come back from holiday, that there's a sense of possibility that you get in liminal spaces, or being away from your normal circumstances, so you're not at home anymore, you're not doing your regular job. There's a sense of possibility about what you could be and what you could do, and maybe what you thought you wanted to be or wanted to do that comes back. I certainly get some of my most powerful ideas, creative ideas, when I'm away from home, when I'm just somewhere else.
Yeah, absolutely. Even not relate. Say I may have went to France or something to see megaliths. I might get an idea for a book or an article on liminal spaces that has nothing to do with the megaliths, but it was just that switch from normality. Again, I'm in an in-between state, and in that sort of pause in reality, in that pause in existence or experience, it becomes something else. And I think that's why these musical soundtracks actually they help convey the sensation of those. I mean, it'll be a fantastic video if someone's ever to make a documentary of like pieces of music and put them through liminal spaces. You know, it would I think it would be an amazing it would actually help describe the thing much better. You know, there's I was thinking and as a, you know Kubrick back to Kubrick again. That scene in the toilets in The Shining where he's talking to Grady's ghost or demon or whatever it is. And the urinals are all have these red dividers between them. And they're going back with these very harsh fluorescent lighting all around them. And he's dressed in like a denim jacket talking to this guy who's dressed formally. And the two states could not be more contrasting. You know, the old time butler or whatever he is and the and this guy who's like basically an alcoholic writer. And all during the scene, Jack Nicholson is doing this with his hand. Torrance is doing this with his hands. It's the weirdest thing. Like if you watch the scene again, and whatever he's doing, it doesn't have any play in the scene, but there's something about the strange movements he does with his fingers that actually, it's like you watch that scene. Okay, they're having a discussion about he's talking to a ghost. He's talking about he tells him we have a situation here. This guy that this the Scatman Crothers is coming back because he has a conversation with the little boy. He's psychic, but it was just it wouldn't be as powerful if it was just that alone with the scene. There's something about his fingers. This is this thing with the liminal space. It amplifies something that's different from the environment around it very highly. I find personally, like a flickering light or something. Or like a single table with a cable with a tablecloth on it.
Yeah, it's really like that. It doesn't. It's like non-human in a way. Thinking about architecture again, it's like design of buildings and living spaces and working spaces, that some of the things that we're thinking about and calling liminal spaces have almost been, designed and signed off by people who then no longer have any connection with it. If you see what I mean, there's no longer any human connection there. The people who design the electricity substation, or the motorway service station, or the toilets in a big hotel or whatever, they're kind of not associated with anymore. And you'll notice in architecture often, they talk about the famous architect who designed this, that, or the other, particularly in neoclassical stuff. I mean, we can talk all day about the horrible, the grotesque built environment around us in many of our cities at this point. But there was a time, certainly, when you say, oh, yes, the famous so and so designed this and built that and everything. But a lot of what we're terming as liminal spaces don't have that kind of connection. It's almost like the people who designed them, or and even built them, were somehow just mediums, and the work was done, and then they were gone from it, and no longer had a human footprint on it.
Yeah, and that's another thing I was thinking about recently about liminal space is the actual chronology of them. It seems to me that they didn't really exist before, say, the Bauhaus movement and that kind of architecture taking off, and the straight lines and the box-like energy. I can't think of any examples of in any other form of architecture that have liminals. I may be wrong to have liminal spaces. I often wonder, that famous painting of the megaliths, where they start off and they're all straight, and then time goes by and they crumble into nothing. If the megaliths are a lot older, like something like Stonehenge is a lot older than and was finished, those stones are finished with straight edges, and what we're only seeing now is the heavily weathered version of what once existed. Well, that would be you'd have to literally go back to then to find a similar kind of built environment that would have that same sort of energy. Because they would have the same sparseness that we have in the late 20th century and into the 21st century. I can't think. Can you think of anything prior to, say, the Bauhaus movement that could possibly be? I can't think of anything at all.
No. I mean, certainly the 20th century represented a step change, because even, if you look back to Victorian architecture, there's still a lot of neoclassical stuff going on. And people, like I mentioned, James Hardcastle earlier, people who are very critical of modern architecture point this out. This is a relatively recent development of vulgarization of things in which took over in the second half of the 20th century. So prior to Bauhaus, similar, it wasn't all bad by any means, but I can't think of anything that's comparable to what you're saying.
Well, some of the interiors of Japanese buildings have that can be kind of similar. They're kind of not I wouldn't say minimal, but they do have that sort of Spartan look that we didn't have in European architecture at the time. And I often remember that scene in Enter the Dragon in the Hall of Mirrors with Bruce Lee. That's was like one of the first kind of like strange environments I saw in the cinema as a child that really like blew my mind. Like this Hall of Mirrors that he was in. And but I really can't no, I can't think of anything that's uniquely a 20 and 24. Well, probably not even. It's probably not even a 21st century. It's only, well, maybe it is, but it seems to. Well, maybe it is because I'm thinking about it. A lot. There's an awful lot of websites and videos on the internet now of American shopping malls that are either down to their last few retail outlets or abandoned, and they definitely. Well, these were ones at their height in the 1980s, and they. Definitely, absolutely, amplify that liminal space notion, and so perhaps that's it. Maybe it's the decline of the great shopping mall is what's really triggering this.
Oh yeah, so it might sound like a pimp for a counselor at the minute because I keep mentioning his name, but
It's
his book
fun.
from about 94, James Hardcastle, his book The Geography of Nowhere, speaks about the banality and a bankruptcy of urban infrastructure in the US, including shopping malls. And you're right. I mean, the images are all over the place. And we talked about the occurrence of these in pop culture. And I mentioned to you in one of my emails, Dawn of the Dead, George Romero's second in his great trilogy of zombie films, which takes place in a mall. And really, that speaks in so many ways to some of the issues that we're talking about.
It's actually his best movie, I think, and that definitely is there. It's kind of closing down, and it's obvious that the zombies are going to come in. I've noticed that the shots become tighter and tighter. The mall becomes more and more compressed. So Romero was a visionary. That film was what, 1982. And he was already sort of like psych or artistically visualizing what was to come.
One thing that when you first started to, we yeah, started to have a conversation about having this chat that sprung to mind was the C-19 period that we all lived through. Again, attempting to use some coded words here, as you do, on your channel, just to keep things above board and clean. At that point, the whole thing that human, because in Dawn of the Dead, what was so clear was that, in the narration where they talk about they come here, they're not really sure why they come here. It's some remembered behavior, whatever. It was just shopping, it was fucking shopping. And the one thing during the C-19 episode that became really clear was that what people really wanted to do, above all else, was get back to shopping. That was like, forget everything else about life, the universe, and everything. Please God, let us get back to shopping. And I remember during that time, as things began to loosen up, IKEA, the big Swedish, home and furniture, blah blah blah, chain. Their outlet just south of Leeds. There were some aerial footage, some drone footage around that when the first day that they opened up, and there were so many people that wanted to go into IKEA or IKEA, as we're supposed to call it, according to Swedes, that there was a 2 hour wait to get in there, 2 hour standing in line to get into IKEA, to at best, have some meatballs.
And everything about that shop is a liminal space from the outside. That the graphic design,
Yes.
everything, even our catalogs, even our instruction manuals, are like have that element to them. Funny you mentioned that. I remember during the Rona when they first rolled out the needlecraft, the TV news here. I was interviewing people actually in the neighborhood in Dublin I grew up in, and there were all the they gave they rolled it out to the elderly first. So there was all these people in their late 70s and 80s getting their. The getting the needlecraft, and they asked the couple, elderly couple, they must have been in nearly 80. So, what will be the first thing you look forward to now that you've got out? And an 80-year-old man, without even hesitation, almost like his life depended on it, shouted out, "Shopping!" Like that
There
scene,
you go.
shopping, like that scene in Trainspotting where they asked the girls what you thought about shopping. It was like that. Literally, that was the zombies, and George Romero had predicted. The term liminal or liminality comes from all things anthropology, and it's often to denote the state of pubescent boys who are going from childhood to manhood, and the rituals and so on, the rites of passages that are undertaken within these cultures and these societies to help bring the boy into manhood. Now, was thinking about that the other day, and I was thinking, I wonder if this whole interest in the liminal space and things like that now is our own kind of pubescent rite of passage, moving from the digital world or the analog world or the regular world, the human world, into the AI world. And this is almost like I said at the beginning, we're being prepared somehow, and this is part of it.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. That sounds really plausible, actually. And for me, it feels kind of ironic because it's not what I would have felt in my initial, awakening to the idea of a liminal space, for that to be about it, the very opposite, actually. So that for me, it would be kind of an inversion of that in some way. But yeah, it's still a plausible thought piece, you know.
The whole thing of every reaction has an equal and opposite reaction, but it's happening on like the level of consciousness that like natural law will still control the situation somehow. Even it's remarkable when you start thinking of that level that like there's an evolutionary process to it, a real sort of evolutionary process to it to help us deal with the, or maybe even to rebel against, to show us the liminal space and the emptiness and the deadness of it. Is to maybe to show it's somehow whatever this intelligence ruling the universe is almost like showing us, well, this is the end game for the AI world as well. If you throw your whole life, if you throw humanity into the AI world, you're going to end up like the shopping center from the 1980s eventually. Empty, unused, and unwanted.
Yeah, so this is interesting to kind of ponder in that context because for me, in a lot of dimensions that we've been speaking about already about the liminal space, there's pluses and negatives. There's kind of things that I felt positive about, things I can remember, in a good way. And then, the dystopian kind of dimensions of it where you're thinking, this is not good. This speaks to a bleak future for humanity. So when I spoke earlier about electricity substations and those little bits of the railway, between the track and someone's, back of someone's garden, who owns that? For me as a child, that was a positive thing. It was somewhere I could be, alone more or less, and really I enjoyed that. No other humans there, as it were. And no one else seeking to occupy that space. They were just kind of like, why would you want to be there? If you see what I mean.
Yeah, I had experience on the railways as well. I remember, like in the north side of Dublin, there were two freight lines that went across the city, and at night you'd have the odd freight train go by once in every hour, but it wasn't busy. And I used to have these magical experiences, almost like psychedelic walking along the train line in the dark. There was no street lights because it wasn't like part of the public highway. At the backs of people's houses on either side, and then the red light in the distance of the signal, and it's changing to green. You knew a train was coming, and then you'd get off the tracks and wait for, there was something. Oh my God! It was literally psychedelic.
Yeah, very much so. Because for just only about 2 years, if I remember rightly, I lived in a small village, seaside village, with a railway track that ran directly through it and behind the house, literally at the end of our back garden. Just literally over there was over the fence was the railway track. It was actually, some of our Irish viewers might recognise it, Castle Rock, in County Londonderry. You've got the train line from Belfast to Derry, as it was at the time. And back in the day, they used to stop at Castle Rock. I don't think they do anymore. I'm not sure. But
It's a beautiful place.
it is, yeah, it's a lovely spot. The whole north coast, northwest coast,
Yeah.
is beautiful in Ireland. But yeah, I had that strong sense of, because I used to occasionally step over the back fence of the garden, and I knew the trains only came once an hour, so I was able to walk on the tracks and in the bits either side of the tracks, with impunity. And I remember having this sense, and even down about another few hundred yards, I would say, down the line, literally was a tunnel that it went underneath the, because they tunneled, as they often did when they were building train tracks, they tunneled through the mountain. Because it was so much cheaper, surprisingly, than going over it. And I actually walked into the tunnel at one point, and that felt so transgressive. But it was literally like, I don't know how to express it, but it was such a liminal space in the sense that has anyone other than the builders of this tunnel ever walked into this tunnel, when they could, theoretically get crushed by an oncoming train?
The magic of live Zoom. I think we've cracked a mystery of a liminal space in the pre-technological era, the railway tunnel. Of course, that makes perfect sense. Have you seen that Charles Dickens, A Ghost Story of Christmas from the BBC, The Signalman with Denham Elliot? My God, that thing's full of haunted liminal space with the tunnel and everything, the camera zooms. So yeah, that would have been something that did exist back then, that you would probably be close to it.
Yeah, I mean the program you're referring to, that's widely available, online or DVD if people want to check it out. Thoroughly recommend it. It's a great ghost story, isn't it? And it lives on the legend for a reason, doesn't it? So.
I remember seeing that as a kid. It left a huge impression on me, understanding cinema and everything. Now that beautifully brings me to the next thing I wanted to talk about. I think there's a Fortean aspect to this as well. I think I'll give you an example. You mentioned trains, the London Underground. The way those tunnels are designed, as the tubes, literally. And when the train is coming down, you might be the only person on a station late at night, and you feel the breeze coming down the tunnel, and then you'll hear the train coming from the distance, and it eventually arrives where you are. There's something, I'm not surprised, the way those stations are designed with the arched, the whole thing is a tube, literally, with tile, that are usually often tiled all the way around, and then you have interconnecting tunnels, very liminal spaces. There's almost a conjuration element to that. Almost like it's so intense, you can manifest things into reality. I'm not surprised that the London Underground has so many ghost stories connected to it. There's a very good documentary, a Channel 4 one called Ghosts of the Underground. And it's just worth watching alone for the use of cinematography in the documentary. It really shows the liminal space quality of these tube stations. They're very quiet, and I think terrible things have happened in them, like where people have been killed in World War II in crushes and things like that, that left them with these kind of psychic residue. But I think that wouldn't happen. I mean, I lived in New York. There's almost no stories of the New York subway being haunted or anything like that that I'm aware of. But yet the London one is full of them. And I think a lot of it has to do with the design of it, that it's literally tubes.
Yeah, there's a whole literally subculture there, isn't there? And you're absolutely right. And I've felt that, and it's one of the things that I notice visiting London is that when you enter the underground, as you inevitably do, it's just one of the ways to get around the city, that you have that something happens when you do that. And I think that a lot of London residents, maybe whether they were born in London or like most people in London actually have just moved there, I'm maybe not aware of this. So as an outsider, I certainly feel it very strongly when I enter that space, something changes immediately,
Yeah, I remember that very good, like as a young lad, 17, 18, even the smell of the arcing of the electric trains under the ground, it even hits you. The air is different. It's a very different kind of air. And the underground map itself looks almost like the very famous and legendary underground. It's almost like a sigil or something. And how you have the nodes and the points where you have to go, everything is a sort of like a it, is related to destiny and destination.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. The whole thing has a quality about it that's just way beyond. It's like a public transport system. It just does.
Yeah, absolutely. And our secret of hidden tunnels underneath there that I've used in wartime and everything. There's so much like legendary things surrounded by it. And in terms of cinematic thing, I always remember that scene in American Werewolf in London where the poor guy is being chased through the he hears the wolf howling, the werewolf howling in the tunnel in the distance, and it chases him up the escalators, and he's at the top of the escalator looking down. It's a classic liminal space view, and then the werewolf appears just out of nowhere to look at him.
Yeah, this has got n nothing to do with liminal spaces, but in terms of movies based in the underground, in fact, one that's totally d that set there and dependent on it is Death Line. I don't know if I re recommended that to you, but yeah, Death Line. It's a 70s horror film set in the London Underground. So to yourself and all viewers and listeners. I recommend that. It's a really interesting piece.
I've never seen that.
Mind the gap. Mind the gap. When you watch the film, you'll remember me saying that. Mind the gap. Interestingly, when we're talking about traveling and transport, we spoke earlier about the C-19 episode, and we're talking about liminal spaces. This is one of the interesting things that happened during that time was it was so many places normally, full of the public were emptied out, and they for those of us who persisted in traveling and getting on the train or whatever, going to these places, we had this really interesting experience. And obviously, you and I are old enough to be remembering decades gone by when different things happened. Regarding responses, we lived through 9/11, different responses to crises, shall we say. Then the C-19 thing came along, and then I don't know what you were doing. I mean, I know some of it because you're Rona Chronicles, for example, and I did a load of videos around that time. But there was a very interesting experience of the public space to be had during that time when it was emptied out by most people who were just, for better or worse, not engaging anymore in travel or in being in places where people gathered.
Well, that hit me like a ton of bricks back then because I remember I had to travel from Belfast down to Dublin, and Belfast was open, but Dublin was still under a very strict lockdown. And I got the bus from Belfast down to the bus station in Dublin. It was normal life. It was life as normal in Belfast. You wouldn't even have known there was any kind of like Rona event. And I got down to Dublin, and it was like, yeah, into the bus station, completely empty, just like the few getting off the bus. And that was a painful experience for me. That was one of the few times I came close to tears during that whole thing. It's like, what have they done to our world?
Yeah, and that's the dark dimension of the liminal space, isn't it? The supposed apocalyptic one, that humans have vanished, as it were. Whatever you say about our dirty, grubby, fornicating, defecating species, we have some things going for us, One thing, a term that came back into my head when we were discussing having this chat with psychogeography. We're talking about liminal spaces and psychogeography, which is kind of, again, a bit of an arcane term. But there's a whole subculture of writing and thought about that. But it's just how we interact with our, the built environment, the spaces that we ourselves create, but which for many people feel somehow alien, like they have no part in. And that, to me, that's very, very interesting. You're out there in the city, the town, the village, whatever, and there are these spaces built, designed, and built by fellow humans, but somehow that you feel that you have no part in. And the psychogeography is, I guess, is just the kind of the science, the art of how we interact and move in those spaces.
That actually came out of a lot of the writings on psychogeography tend to be written by Marxists, and
Yes, they
it's
do,
very
yeah.
weird. They do it's kind of like it's interesting, but I always found that. And also, a lot of the roots of the hauntological scene are written by communists as well. I found that very interesting.
Mark Fisher was
Yeah,
a hardcore leftist, wasn't he?
he ended up killing himself.
He did,
After
yeah.
he's it was sad, he left the wife and kids, but after his communist utopia didn't come through. And his writings on ontology are brilliant, absolutely amazing. But his writings on communism are complete, they were complete, I mean, just complete nuts stuff. I remember I came across him first when he reviewed, I remember when Russell Brand first broke about 10 years ago among. They were trying to make an all-star out of him. He had a touring show called Messiah Complex, and Mark Fisher wrote a review of the thing, describing it as being the most healthy expression of communism he had seen in a long time. I mean, absolute rubbish, But yeah, at the same time too, his writings on ontology, it's like, how does he reconcile that with the other? I mean, I know we're all complex people, but I often wonder if that dichotomy within him is what ultimately led him to kill himself, which is kind of an interesting idea. Is he was fighting his individuality against the mass, the whole lack of individuality within Marxism and communism, which he was equally devoted to as well. Actually, some guy, maybe Legalized Freedom or someone else, who should actually study his work and get into and talk about him sometime, because he it's like he was a very contradictory but very interesting person.
Yeah, I mean, I would have had him as a guest if he'd lived, but by the time I read his book, Ghosts of My Life, he was already dead. But I loved the book, it just spoke to me in so many ways. So yeah, it was just sad, really. And I think if he hadn't been, devoted to leftism and, some kind of redundant ideology, how's that working out for you? Has anyone ever tried communism? Has that ever been tried in the past? How did it work out? If he hadn't been d devoted to that he might have lived.
Well, it's like his right brain was ontology and his left brain was Marxism, and he was a classic product of academia. But I also find it interesting, you mentioned psychogeography, and a lot of the writings that formulate the psychogeography came out were French Marxists, and it was in terms of things such as the economic status of different communities and neighborhoods as you pass through them, and the a sort of a kind of like a, from a sort of a sociological viewpoint. And that also be developed into something very interesting as well, because then people developed their own version of psychogeography, where you would just go into, it was a big thing in New York when I was there, you would just say, go wander in the Lower East Side late at night for no reason, and it is a, I guess that was sort of like rooted in the same thing that's brought us to liminal space, even though the aesthetic would have been very different, that you still would have had that those sensations overcome you.
Yes, absolutely. Another thing that sprung to mind when you first proposed this talk was I'm about to do, coming up very shortly, a talk with the author Samantha Lee Treasure about her book Out of Body Experiences. And one of the things that she identifies in some of the out of body and dream and just being somewhere else in terms of consciousness spaces is people or the lack of them, and how that seems to be a feature of the out of body experience. And also, interestingly, she identifies the shopping mall as, for a lot of out of body experiencers, as a communal meeting space. If you see what I mean, in that dream environment, in the out of body environment, a shopping mall thinly populated. And that fired off all sorts of thoughts in my mind, relevant to this. We were talking earlier about Dawn of the Dead, the movie, and that being set in a shopping mall. Again, it's closed, there's almost no one there. And this also got me thinking about in terms of, like, these liminal spaces, there not being many humans there and many people there, as to the whole idea of tulpas. And how many, and this is a central theme of, like, my work going forward, how many people, quote unquote, in the world are human? How many are generated by us in terms of, thought forms? If we think of Dolores Cannon's background people, I think that was the first time I ever encountered it, with Dolores Cannon. And what was the name of her book? Three something waves and a new three waves of volunteers in the new earth, something like that. And I read on a page of her book about this soon.
A common associate of ours, Gary Vaysey, has written about liminal people. And he told me of an experience he had in the Czech Republic, wherever he lives, where he saw this woman here, that was a woman on the street that wasn't actually there. It's a very, again, it they again we, they all seem to tie in. You just remind me of something else. Do you remember shopping precincts?
Of
They were
course, yeah.
kind of, the Americans had shopping malls, but we had shopping precincts. And they were all built in the 60s. They weren't enclosed. They were usually just like fake streets opened, made of concrete. They had the store, but they were very much, they were actually rooted in a French Marxist, the whole brutalistic design of architecture. Again, French Marxism. So it's, we keep coming back to the shopping, the abandonment of shopping. We talked about shopping malls. We've spoken about IKEA. We've spoken about now the precincts, and you know, so it's. I know there's something to that. You know, that's. It's again that the first. It's a very frustrating subject, is because you know, you're t there's something there to be, you know, the gold nugget in there is somewhere in the seam, but you're not getting it. There's an endless sense. Maybe that's part of the process. The frustration is the kind of the evolution of it.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, we're being challenged. And also you mentioned when these a lot of these shopping precincts were built. I mentioned earlier J.G. Ballard and High Rise and the Concrete Island. And for me, brutalist architecture, which I've actually got a sort of a fondness for, because it's so ontological. It really does speak of a lost future. It's like this is how the world is going to be, but it never happened. If you see what I mean, all those admittedly kind of vulgar tower blocks of flats that were built in the UK and other countries as well in the 60s and 70s that are already demolished. They're gone. It's just acknowledged that people don't want to live like that, and that's what high rise speaks to the book and the film. But for me, that that molded concrete thing has a certain kind of appeal to it. And again, when I see those spaces, it's like when you think back to utopian schemes for the future, like the Zeitgeist movement and what the hell was it called? Jacques, whatever. It's the His whole idea for the future was all this molded concrete, but there were no people there. I can't remember what the name of his project was, but if you look Zeitgeist Movement, if you Wikipedia that, you'll find a link to
Yeah,
this guy.
the Venus Project.
Venus Project, yeah. What was that all about? Concrete, utopian future, no people.
They were
So
empty.
that, yeah.
I have a great story for that about that. I grew up in one of those brutalistic estates and tower blocky office, you know, tower blocky building blocky things. And in the around 2008-ish, the I took an American lady up to see where I grew up, because the place was going to be demolished very shortly and redeveloped. And so the buildings were all empty. No one was living in them. And I wanted to show the flat that I grew up in. And I got there and it was gone. It had been, I hadn't been there in probably years. It had been demolished the morning before I was arrived. And there was water spraying on the building to keep the asbestos down. And it was just a strip of rubble where it was once a tower, not a tower block, but a multi-story sort of like long block of flats. And I said to the guy who was working there, I says, "Can you get me a piece of concrete from just about there? Because that's where my bedroom was growing up." And he got it and he picked it up and he says, "Will this do?" And the moment he said that, an enormous lightning bolt went down behind him. Not didn't hit him, but went in the sky behind him. It was just one of these weird, like the chances of everything happening that day didn't happen. Now, people who lived around the neighborhood, they had welded door before they knocked all the buildings down. They had welded shut steel plates in front of them, of the doors and the entrance to the lift shafts, so no one could get, so they didn't want anyone climbing up and falling off or anything. So you couldn't get into these 8-story tower blocks that were all over the place on 15th. People who lived in houses nearby said at 3 o'clock in the morning, and that would be on those times, lights would come on in these buildings, one here, one there, and you see they would said they saw people in the windows, but the buildings were completely abandoned, had no access, as if they were seeing, were they generating topos, were they seeing ghosts? But I found that stuff fascinating when I heard about it. That there was a magical quality to that place when it was being destroyed. It was like all the life that existed in it was showing up as a kind of a psychic, kind of like the things we've covered on shows in the past, like the stone tape thing.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. These apparently, inert entities take on the energy of the events around them. Absolutely, that's the case. That's again and again. That seems to be the source of hauntings, for example. And if you watch, as you mentioned, the TV movie The Stone Tape, you'll see that's the whole exposition there really is setting that idea out.
It just goes to show you what the liminal space thing encompasses when you start like talking around its edges. Again, it's this frustrating jigsaw. We have the jigsaw piece, but we don't have the picture on the box. That's the way I'd probably describe it. It's almost like that in a way. So I think that I don't really have anything else to add. Do you have anything else after this?
Simply in closing, Thomas, I would say that I was on holiday recently, with my girlfriend, who's quite a lot younger than me, and we stopped off at various motorway service stations on our trip, for obvious reasons, toilet break, grab a coffee, get a pasty, you name it. And without prompting, she spoke about finding these spaces really interesting in a unique way without really being able to articulate why. And upon probing a bit further, it was clear that this was something unique, a transitional space, a liminal space, a bit like the airport. No one in the motorway service station is where they actually want to be. They might be having a good time there with their pasty and their coffee or whatever, but everyone's moving on. And there's maybe even possibilities in these liminal spaces that don't exist in our other day-to-day lives in work and home, where we have fixed ideas and fixed relationships. Maybe in these liminal spaces, other possibilities open up.
Absolutely, I can't agree. We're going to be doing this again in the future to come in a different way. I've no doubt about it. Do you have anything else coming up? Are you doing the conference up with Neil MacDonald in Preston?
No, I'm not speaking this year. If listeners would like to check out my recent interview with Neil MacDonald on Mysterious Earth Conference Update, I have a chat with him about who's speaking this year. Neil was gracious enough to have me speak in 2023 and 2024. Not speaking this year, but I will be there as an attendee. But other than that, going forward, legalizefreedom.com is the website, podcasts happening. And yeah, that's about it.
Well, thanks very much, Greg, and no doubt we'll be touching on this one again. So, thanks again, everybody, for not quite the witching around tuning in again. And fill the comments up below. What does a liminal space to you mean? And is there anything we haven't discussed? Because again, this is definitely a conversation for all of us. So, good night, everybody.
LegalizeFreedom.com